Hi, everyone. This is Brian Kilmeade. You may know me from Fox News Channel's Fox and Friends and more, and the Brian Kilmeade Radio Show. Now I'm excited to share my new book, The President and the Freedom Fighter, Abraham Lincoln, Frederick Douglass, and their battle to save America's soul. It's about the little-known story of how two American heroes and patriots disagreed, united, and changed the course of history and made America free for all. It's available now wherever books are sold.
Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the November 5th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim. I'm president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He's an author, political commentator, and the founder of the eponymous investment firm, say it with me, The Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Hello, Will. How many people do you think said it with you?
I think there are probably the majority of our listeners can probably read that intro word for word. Hey, we have a very brisk time allotment here. So without further ado, I want to talk first, if it's okay with you, I just want to reflect on what happened in Virginia, because I think it has real application for California. And just to refresh everybody, Republicans swept all statewide offices. They rode to glory or infamy, if you're a progressive lefty, on parental outrage about what had gone on in schools in Virginia with COVID closings, mask mandates, vaccine mandates, what was revealed in the curriculum when parents were sitting in on Zoom and watching their kids get lectured on critical race theory. We can talk a little bit about that. But the bottom line is parents were showing up in school districts just in Virginia, just as they were in California. And Youngkin himself really seized on that energy. And I want to know, why, David, do you think that the same sort of energy that was just evident throughout the state of California didn't materialize in a Newsom recall just what, 6 weeks ago? So talk to me.
Well, you already know the reason, and our honest listeners know the reason, and a lot of people don't like the reason, and I don't blame them. I'm not here to rub salt or troll or dunk or any of these things, but obviously, the people in California were livid at the shutdowns in school, and not maybe not as livid as the more moderate state of Virginia, but there's plenty of concern about teacher unions and abuses and CRT and other things here too. I don't think that the population of California is as fired up and principled about the school curriculum matters as the Virginia voters were. But I think that more or less those were really big positives to the cause of recalling Gavin Newsom net. And yet it did go entirely differently. And it's not just Virginia, it's New Jersey too. New Jersey still ended up getting a Republican state Senate director, heads of the state Senate. It's a Republican candidate for governor, only lost by less than 1 point. It took him 24 hours to go through. That's how tight that vote was, where that incumbent governor had been winning by 14 points in the polls. And yet California's recall went very differently. And there's only one difference. And it was what we've already talked about on the podcast regarding the insanity around focusing on illegitimacy of the Biden administration, on January 6th stuff, on just things around the persona of Trump. And I think that there's a playbook forming. I've heard in the last 72 hours, a lot of friends of mine that are much more pro-Trump, the person than I have been, say, you know what, the right play here is to take the best parts of Trump's policy and Trump's movement and move on, but without him necessarily connected. I was listening to a podcast this morning with Jason Whitlock, who I like a lot. He's an old Fox Sports guy, and he's on Fox News sometimes. He's an African-American commentator. He can get pretty spicy, and he's been a big pro-Trump guy, and I like him a lot. And on his podcast, I was listening to walking to my office this morning. He was saying, yeah, you know, we have to be able to move on. He's had his run. He's done what he's done. We can continue to, you know, leverage the good parts of the platform. But yeah, I mean, this thing with Glenn Youngkin and so forth, there's candidates that can win with empathy, with positivity, with grace. And I don't think we're stuck to the personality of one person. And I think that I don't happen to like that personality, but even if I did, I would still say the same thing. That just pragmatically, I really hope a lot of our listeners that don't like what you and I say when we talk about Trump, I hope they can hear this point, that if all you care about is the cause, if all you care about is defeating CRT, cancel culture, abusive suppression of parental rights in the school district, if all you care about are those issues, then maybe the best way to win on those issues is in a sort of post-Trumpian context, and that new era might be more people like a Glenn Youngkin than it might be, the old guard. That's my take. I say it with as much grace and civility as I'm able to muster.
And you did it without breaking a sweat. So good job. Hey, just to reprise our conclusion about the recall, just like Terry McAuliffe, the Democratic gubernatorial candidate in Virginia, Gavin Newsom's campaign during the recall was to set the Trump trap. And Larry Elder walked right into it by first saying, hey, look, I'm not here to debate. This is very early on. Larry mentions it, he announces his candidacy. And then he's asked point blank about the November elections, and distinguishing himself like Youngkin from Trump. He first says, hey, those elections were fair and square. They're done. Now let's focus on California. And then days later, looking at Twitter, Larry Elder's campaign freaks out and responds that the election was actually probably, very hinky and stolen and suspicious. And that's it. The trap sprung on Larry's leg, and the media did the rest of Newsom's work for him. Youngkin managed to avoid that and just rode parental outrage, tax issues. I mean, just really, I think, the phrase bread and butter has been overused with Youngkin, but he really did just hit kind of like, I think, really solid suburban middle class Republican virtue, and managed to get an African-American lieutenant governor in as well. And then the first Latino AG in Virginia's history wins, also a Republican. So I think there's something here. And you
that lieutenant governor, by the way, that's a story. Our father came in as an immigrant to find economic opportunity from dirt poor Jamaica in the 1960s, had $1.75. Just beautiful American immigrant story. And now she is the Republican lieutenant governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia. I love this stuff, Will.
Yeah, it can happen here. And I would
very similar to another beautiful story of a woman who had an affair with Willie Brown.
Yeah, whose father was also from Jamaica, if I'm not mistaken.
And climbed the political ladder through all sorts of corporate and political shenanigans, and is now the vice president of the United States. It's beautiful. It brings a tear to your eye.
And Kamala Harris was all in. I mean, the Biden administration was all in. It was so interesting to watch Virginia, because they really did do the same sort of national thing with the gubernatorial election. Kamala Harris shows up, Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden, Barack Obama. There's like a checklist of all the folks who showed up in California. And there was Kamala Harris, right by Terry's side, saying, this is the most important election ever. As goes Virginia, so goes the nation. Well, Kamala, from your lips to God's ears. But
don't skip over what she said after the election,
please. Oh, yes. Thank you.
Yeah. She said before the election, as Virginia goes, so goes 22 and 24. And then what she said after the election was, there were some huge wins.
We had great wins, she said Wednesday. You and I are recording Friday.
She apparently wasn't referring to the Seattle city council positions, or the Minneapolis defund the police position, or any ballot that happened in the state of Virginia, or a whole handful of ballots in New Jersey She wasn't referring to any of those things. So what was she referring to, Will?
She says, we have Eric Adams in New York. In Ohio, we had Mrs. Brown.
All right, now let's stop. No. But do you mind? I'm sorry, Will. Do you mind? You always set the agenda, and I think that you deserve to have your agenda honored. But can I interrupt real quickly on her first one? So Eric Adams is her great victory. Okay.
Right.
So they run a hyper-progressive candidate, Maya Wiley. They back her. They fund her. She's on MSNBC. This chick is a lunatic. All right. Let me tell you something. Unhinged. And Adams wipes the floor with her in the primary. So the election was already over. It's a 7-1 registration advantage. The guy who ran as Republican, I've met several times. I like him. He's well known from the 80s for founding the Red Beret organization called Guardian Angels. Obviously, the thing was over. Eric Adams was registered as a Republican for a good part of his adult life. He ran on a tough on crime bill. He ran on a quasi form of still holding on to stop and frisk. He has been hanging out with hedge funders. He's done fundraisers at the Hamptons. He ran as an anti-progressive. Now, did he run as a conservative Republican? No. But my point is, Kamala Harris knows that he won by running away from the progressive agenda, not towards it. And every Republican or moderate he's sitting down with, I sat down with him a few weeks ago, he's talking about repudiating class warfare. We need to bring wealthy, productive people back to the city. We need tough on crime. No one wants to be in the schools if their kids are not safe. He's not running as a let's replace the police force with a group of marshmallows or something. I mean, I don't know. So she's lying through her teeth. Eric Adams' thing is a victory for our side on a relative basis. You grade these things on a curve, and everyone knows it.
I love that you brought that up. Let's talk about staying with that theme about the fact that there is something to be there was a smackdown of progressivism here. There's a terrific article. I believe it was Chris Morton who sent it to me, listener Chris Morton, and the headline here, San Francisco Chronicle, is even in San Francisco, progressives are seeing a backlash. And we don't have to get into all the details here because you and I have covered an awful lot of this. You've got the Chase of Bodine, I'm sorry, the DA is being recalled now. You've got three members of the city of the school district, San Francisco Unified School District, being recalled. My favorite there, again, just I don't mean to keep smacking her, Allison Collins, school board member, who was vilified by her own colleagues on the board for tweeting out anti-Asian slurs and has actually sued the board for millions of dollars, then abandoned that lawsuit. I mean, these are some pretty terrible people who found time during the pandemic to rename schools because they thought the racist legacy of
Abraham Lincoln.
Of Abraham Lincoln. Right. There you go. And Dianne Feinstein. So you've got this, the guy's conclusion here in this wonderful article is, I think, worth reporting. It's even here in the birthplace of so many social justice movements, voters are showing a tenuous, I think he means a tentative shift back to the center on the kinds of cultural issues that could be deeply motivating precisely because they're so personal. I mean, it sounds like conservatism to me. A similar move nationally could prove devastating to Democrats on a national level in the 2022 congressional midterms. Now, this article comes out before the results from Virginia, and he's already identifying this shift where progressives in San Francisco are they're under attack now from moderate Democrats and liberals in San Francisco who've just kind of had enough with high crime, high murder rate, open-air drug markets. David, just out, I think this morning, San Francisco is now contemplating a vaccine passport required for children as young as 5 to go out into public places. So this is a city with...
You know what? That's going to really screw up life for all 13 of the children in San Francisco.
Those whose families could afford to stay in the city. You know, just staying with that idea here, you've got even London Breed, San Francisco Mayor London Breed, coming out and just going nuts because the San Francisco Planning Commission, the supervisors bailed on a housing project for the homeless. citing a whole bunch of concerns about white gentrification and the loss of low-income property. Here was a housing project backed by the moderate political establishment. And yeah, I'm talking about London Breed increasingly, who's, you know, kind of an interesting figure for us to watch, because she had come in as a very progressive person and is now running constantly up against her far, far left flank. So the supervisors vote 8-3 to bail out of this housing project that would have taken a vacant lot, produced hundreds and hundreds of new homes, including 100 homes for very low income people. One of the supervisors who voted for the project said, if met, the criteria for approval would have created 100 plus new affordable homes. If you're wondering how we got into our housing crisis, this is how. Breed writes, supervisors raise vague concerns about gentrification and possible shadows of buildings on casting shadows to justify rejecting the analysis of experts. The planning department, this was a hearing over supposed environmental concerns. We're talking about a parking lot surrounded by high rises. So San Francisco just continues to shoot itself, I think, in the foot. One of my favorite lines in the story here about the housing project was, oh my gosh, where is it? We're punching the golden goose in the face. One of my favorite lines ever. I can't even find it now, but it's brilliant. This is moderates and waking up to the dangers of progressivism. So David, let's talk about one other national story. If we can, just want to go back for a moment and notice that our own Javier Becerra moves from California, goes to the Biden Health and Human Services gig, where he announces that overdose deaths are so high nationally that we have to start embracing some of these ideas that were once seen as taboo. What's he talking about? Javier Becerra is talking about the kinds of illegal drug mitigation policies that would, you know, street drug policies that would help, they think, limit drug use and drug overdoses. He's talking about things like government consumption sites where people can walk in and exchange needles, a needle exchange program, obviously, free drugs, fentanyl testing strips. It's a weird world in which you are derided for getting ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine, just ridiculed publicly and shamed and canceled. But man, go to San Francisco and we will hand you the drugs. And if you needed evidence that California is just bad for America, here it is. Javier Becerra taking this reverse lesson, this bleak outcome. We've talked in the last couple of weeks about the high rate of overdose deaths in San Francisco. You might remember we discussed Michael Schellenberger's piece in which he provocatively but accurately said San Francisco's experiment in decriminalizing drugs and street crime has produced more African-American deaths than the Tuskegee experiment. Remember that one from like a week or two ago. So, David, this is just, you know, Javier Becerra going national and saying, here's his logic. I want to be really fair to Javier. Here's what he's saying. If you can't prevent someone from becoming a user, then at least prevent them from harming themselves to the point of death. He wants to keep active drug users alive. And there's too many strategies out there. This is my favorite line from Becerra. Too many strategies have been left on the table that people have been too afraid to try because of political opposition. He's acting as if somehow, A, he's courageous, and B, there are strategies which have not yet been explored. California has explored all of these, Javier, and you know it. And he's now ready to have this go national. It reminds me of the old Crow medicine show. He's going to be out there flogging stuff we know kills you. And yet this is now the new Biden thing. We're going to get tough on overdose deaths.
Yeah. I don't think we should ever be surprised when a state official, you know, generally when a state official has done a lot of good things, they get brought into Washington, D.C. They then bring some good ideas national. And when a state official has got really bad ideas and they get brought national, they bring bad ideas national. But in this case, I want to say something, because, you know, I have strong opinions about it and I've shared them on the podcast before. The notion of saying, like, we need to find a safe way for someone to kill themselves on drugs. And in his case, he's kind of denying that they'd be killing themselves, because what he's saying is if they don't immediately die from overdose, therefore they're not going to die. But of course,
right,
all he's talking about is the speed of death. drug addiction at this level is a fatal condition. Do they not know that? Is this not, why doesn't everyone go take drugs if they're, what am I missing? Why don't we get everyone addicted to opioids?
Yeah.
Because this is better than death. I mean, this is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. What he's saying is I favor state regulated death to non-regulated death. All right. Well, I don't. I think that the soul of that person matters. I don't. And false dilemmas do not become logical when they come from Washington, D.C. We are not choosing a binary outcome. This is not between someone dying on drugs from unsafe mechanisms of administration or someone dying on drugs through addiction. There is another alternative available, which is someone not being on drugs. How are we having this conversation in a moral society, for God's sake, that we have to pick between which way we want people taking drugs? I pick not taking drugs, and I pick the enforcement of rehabilitation, of education, of medical, spiritual, moral, ecclesiastical support. They're charitable endeavors, rehabilitation homes, feeding the addiction is absolutely unforgivable. And for a politician to claim it is necessary because the only other option is that they're going to die with a dirty needle or a dirty pipe or some fentanyl-laced heroin or these other different things, it's just categorically untrue. And most of the time in life, when someone says it's door one or door two, there is a door three, and there's a door three here, and door three doesn't kill people. It doesn't kill people quickly or slowly. It actually gives them life. Next subject.
So, hey, you know, staying with the wonderful theme of California bad for America, we've got a wonderful piece that just came out, I want to say yesterday, it looks like Wednesday. California is the supply chain's weakest link. You and I have talked at considerable length.
We're number one, baby.
Yeah. We've talked at considerable length about the problem of having California officials manage ports, which account for about 40% of the nation's imports. And we see this in, you know, illustrated dramatically. As I've said before, you just walk out, you know, drive a couple of miles from where I live, closer to where you live near the ocean, you look out toward Catalina, there is a long line of cargo ships out there. And the city of LA, in its wisdom, came out in ignoring all the causes of that cargo backlog, which are government created for the most part. Ignoring the causes of the backlog of cargo ships and container traffic, they have now initiated a fine system for cargo containers which are left too long at the port. The problem, of course, is, as this story makes very, very clear, is that we have done everything we can to make it more difficult for people to pick up and move cargo containers onto the port and out of the port and into a warehouse. The story in the Wall Street Journal, which was sent to me, by the way, by no fewer than three listeners, rather. I want to thank every one of them for hitting that story for us. The point is that we've got all kinds of regulations in place which make it very difficult for a shipper, for a carrier to come in and move this stuff, to move these containers. You've got the longshoremen who have opposed technology change going back decades. These are the people who opposed the introduction of steel containers, cranes, modern trucks, and more recently, any kind of like GPS tracking or skewing of cargo. They have opposed every single thing because every one of these technological improvements, which would speed the movement of container traffic out of the port, might result in a loss of jobs. You've got Assembly Bill 5, which we have maligned endlessly on this show, brought to you by the Teamsters Union-backed Lorena Gonzalez, assemblywoman from San Diego County. And this makes it more difficult for trucks to get in and out of the port. It's just very, very difficult. So you've got this fine system, which is a little bit like walking up to people who are trapped in gridlock traffic that is created by the government and then fining every single driver caught in that jam. That's what they're doing now. So again, politicians look at a problem and say, we know, we'll just fine people. But they don't look at the underlying causes they've created, which generate this catastrophe at the ports, and consequently, all of the United States suffers a rise in prices, barren shelves and stores, and probably a belated arrival of Santa Claus in December. I hope no children are listening.
I'll tell you what, if people, if this keeps up, people are going to start to dislike Californians.
That'd be terrible.
So, you know, I just thought it was interesting. It said like we're the worst on the supply chain thing. And I thought, how many years have we been talking about how we're like 48th in education or 42nd? Yeah. And, you know, it's always, the point has always been relative to our resources and our university system and our tax base and our, you know, what have you, it's unexcusable to even be right. Like the amount of money spent per pupil, like we should be the top 10, not the bottom 10.
Right.
But in this case, we're not even like, oh yeah, this is really bad that we're around the like Mississippi and Alabama area or something like that. We're like, yeah, we're right there. The number one spot. And of course, your point, the nature of the ports and the geography of the country is such, it has a big impact. And you list a lot of the factors that play in, all of which are fixable. It's always a matter of will, never a matter of skill.
Yeah, once again, the Wall Street Journal writer notes that California's Environmental Quality Act, known as CEQA, has limited the ability of companies to open up their warehouses, to expand them. The state has imposed all kinds of green mandates on these warehouses that are typically out, you know, more in the hinterland beyond the ports, you know, in our case, out there in San Bernardino, Riverside counties. That all these regulations have really clamped down on the speed with which we're able to move container traffic, and it finally caught up. You know, at this point, I feel like I'm flogging a dead horse. We've talked about this so much. I do want to point out that our friend Chris Reed, formerly Orange County Register, now an opinion writer at the San Diego Union-Tribune, wrote a brilliant piece, which appeared first on the CPC website, the California Policy Center website. And it's he asks, why didn't California's unemployment office heed past audits? Because real efficiency means fewer jobs. So in keeping with this longshoreman's debacle, this attempt to really regulate truck traffic and pollution down at the port, Chris is looking at the fact that we have now calculated the losses from unemployment fraud during COVID under Newsom at about 20 billion. Some numbers have been as high as 31. I'm going to guess that by the time they're done calculating, it's closer to that $31 billion of money that went directly to, in many cases, people in our own prisons, people overseas who are not even Americans, never mind Californians. So Chris points out that for decades, we have known there was a problem with automation and technology applications inside the unemployment division. And as with the longshoremen, the unions that represent workers in the unemployment office, typically AFSCME or Service Employees International, these guys have opposed the introduction of all technology. Why? Because it would eliminate some union jobs. So what we get in the end is a group of people who were working there struggling with technology that is literally 20 years out of date and maybe worse, unable to track using simple fraud technology. Fraud screening technology. We've got these workers who are really working in the tech stone age because their union won't allow any sort of progress.
Do you have any senior citizens in your life, Will?
Lots. I'm a senior citizen now. Yes.
I know but me. I'm not going to say that on the podcast. People think of you.
You're immature one.
No, it's just you're so hip and cool. And you actually, if anyone ever gets after you about like the ARP jokes or like you get the senior discount at the movie theater, you can just challenge them to a game of punk rock trivia. Because my money's on you, dog. Will, my impression I get visually when you're describing the state of California and the policies around this administration of our unemployment benefits and the ports, the longshoremen fighting different, advancements in the fulfillment processes and whatnot. I picture like, you know, my grandmother's now up in heaven, but like, you know how there is sort of reputation of like that senior citizen in church, their phone rings and they don't know how to like turn the ringer off. And
yeah.
It's not always just senior citizens, by the way. Sometimes it could be me or you or my, Gen Xers, you know.
Right.
But my point is, that's what I'm picturing is like the people that we've tasked. First of all, we've equipped them with gazillions of taxpayer dollars, staff and offices and technology and annual increases. I mean, they have everything, right? But then they can't, like, they get all irritated at, like, the way Microsoft Outlook works or something. I mean, it's just comical. It's comical.
But this is the state that gives, you know, we have Silicon Valley here, and yet we have people who are working on technology that was big when I was a very young man. It's just really, Chris's article is phenomenal. It's like, you know, digging deep into the archives of technology. I could go on, but you get the picture here. And staying with that idea of people who don't understand technology, we've got a governor who is driving us toward an all-electric future, of course. And at the same time, this awesome story, a study comes out from the Institute for Energy Research, a nonpartisan organization that really does just look at energy. And the headline tells you almost everything you need to know. California has too much solar power. So here we have electric shutdowns. Frequently, we have blackouts all over the place. The independent system operator apparently, pardon me, is now very upset, along with the PUC, the Public Utilities Commission, that all this we've had all these blackouts during the summer. And the solar study from the Institute for Energy Research points out that solar only works for a very brief period of time during the day, and we don't have the capacity yet to store it, even though Newsom is driving us toward this all-electric future. And so what's the result? We have to, as they put it here, the operative term of art here is they have curtailed the use of solar multiple times. And that curtailment, that turning off of the solar switch during the day, because it's the only time you get solar, that's when it's really generating a load of power. We can't use it all. We cannot use all the solar we generate right now, but we are constantly building more solar capacity. Now, maybe at some point we'll develop the batteries and the alternative systems, et cetera. But the bottom line is right now that we have a system that generates electricity we can't use, even as we're shutting down every form of fracking, of oil drilling. We've, you know, got this massive campaign now to shut down offshore oil drilling. We're trying to do all these climate change initiatives that really punish us for the use of the kinds of things we need at night when the sun doesn't shine. Right now, that would be fossil fuels, for instance. But the governor can't have that. We have people being unable to light their stoves because there's no more methane piping into, you know, natural gas piping into their new homes. So we have a catastrophe of the central planner. Maybe you could talk to us about the problem of, is it the information problem or the knowledge problem? I can't remember what you call it in your wonderful book, There's No Free Lunch, 250 Lessons in Economics.
250 Economic Truths.
Thank you.
It is the knowledge problem. And this is Friedrich Hayek's contribution to 20th century economic thought, that there is a lot of knowledge dispersed in society, and it is complicated and it is multidimensional, and it requires local optics, not high level centralized optics. And the decision making that comes out of the dispersion of knowledge is going to be imperfect no matter what, because knowledge cannot be dispersed perfectly, and it will be optimized when it is decentralized. And these are things that are readily considered non-controversial by objective intellects, just not when it comes to the administration of public policy. And so right now we talk about need for a lot of central planning and energy. Doesn't feel to me like it's going very well. I'll say something else. And this happened with the blackouts in California, Gray Davis, and our electricity policy. I think that our side's going to win here. I was talking to someone yesterday. National Review did a salon for my new book. And there was a gentleman I was talking to afterwards who was fascinated to understand that capital markets have not shut out oil and gas just because ESG and the corporate woke, you know, crusaders have gone after Chevron and Exxon, that in fact, there are a lot of non-bank lenders, private equity, private credit, folks that actually care about a return on capital, that like the higher expected rates of return that right now the sector provides, that are still perfectly willing to fund capital expenditures in the energy sector. And he was fascinated to hear that there's a market solution to this ESG woke pension fund terrorism. And I very much believe there is. But the other piece that is that exists that is a solution is the lights going out. It is heaters not working. It is heating bills going higher. Those are the events that there is no environmentalist and there is no Al Gore documentary and there is no AOC Instagram post. There is no virtue signaling tweet on God's green earth. See what I did there? That is going to change the fact that they do not have solutions. They only talk about problems. The solutions are on our side. And I think that this is going to be readily apparent, readily visible, readily very clear to American people as these things continue. So that's my optimistic sign of the day. Hey, yeah, you talked the book, Will. Is this a good time for us to talk about the coloring book?
I was just going to ask you. First of all, we are getting people who are writing in. Thank you, listeners, who've written in with proof that you have purchased and reviewed David's book.
I haven't seen any yet. People are starting to.
Yeah, and I'm just sending them directly to Erica over in your office.
But I want to see the reviews.
Oh, okay. I'll send them to you.
I only see one on Amazon so far because the hardcover, Amazon's gotten really strict where you cannot review the book if you're not a verified purchaser.
Mm.
And so let's say that I purchased 40 books for Friends of California Policy Center and we give those out. Mm-hmm. And those people go to review the book, it's not going to let them. That's a newer Amazon policy. Now, people can buy the Kindle and still review it. It posts at all levels. So wherever people are reviewing it, I'd be curious to know where they're posting because I'm waiting to see those Amazon reviews go up. But of course, the book doesn't come out until Tuesday.
Right. The latest came in just this morning from somebody who bought it on Kindle. So maybe take a look over there, too. But just reprises of that offer again, it's buy the book and review it where you buy it. If it's Kindle or Amazon. I'm sorry, I keep referring to my niece's name, Kendall. Sorry about that, guys. That's me being old. And then send us the proof that you reviewed it and we'll send you, David, we'll send them a hard copy of the book and
the coloring book.
The coloring book.
The collector's item coloring book that is incredibly special, getting rave reviews with a set of crayons that are branded for the book. And so we'll send off the goodies to those who send that proof of review. We're going to limit the number of the free books we give out, but we're going to probably keep the coloring book thing going for good. So act quick.
That's really sweet. Thanks, man. Hey, let's take just a moment here to talk about one last story. Inglewood High School beat Morningside High School's football team last Friday, 106-0. And this quickly became international news. My cousin in England, who may be listening right now, sent me the story first, I think, because he was up earlier on Saturday morning and wanted to know, like, what the hell's going on. And so I just wanted to ask you, like, are people who react to this thing, just to back up, this is the Inglewood football team was beating Morningside 59-0 at the end of the first quarter. The coach for Inglewood refused to allow a running clock, and I won't get into the details what that means. It just speeds up the game. And so his team continued to win so handily that toward the end of the final gun, they were ahead. They had just scored. It was 104-0. And the Inglewood coach decides to go for two to make it 106-0. The Morningside coach said it was classless. What I found fascinating in the story was less illuminated, I think, in any of the stories that I saw, but it was the Inglewood coach saying how proud the Morningside coach, the guy who lost, saying how proud he was of his players, that they really did keep their heads up. They fought through to the end. And I'm without excusing the Inglewood coach who ran up the score and has been the subject of much notoriety. The fact that he could find a silver lining here makes me think that, you know, it reminds me of I like to say God pulls rabbits out of hats. That's just what God does. And you could say he pulls people out of hell. Even in that moment, there's a kind of, I don't want to get too Hallmarkian about it, but a kind of a really glorious moment about human dignity that these kids at least as you know, their coach reports it. The coach who's upset about the devastating loss says, "My kids played hard till the end." I think that's the important life lesson here. And if I still ran a newspaper, I would send my reporter out to talk about that aspect of it. You have any thoughts?
Well, I mean, I'm hearing about it for the first time. So how your cousin in Scotland heard about it before I did or whatever is fascinating. But you know what? That is a great way to view the story. It's from the vantage point of the other coach talking about the kids' effort. I don't know if there was a situation where like their third string players went in and were still whooping them. Kids who had never seen the field got a chance to play and they made some big plays. When you start talking about going for two, then you start wondering, like, did the other coach steal this coach's girlfriend or something? I mean, I don't know the story, but certainly to the extent that without me, I have a lot more knowledge to it. The prima facie part of it is kind of horrific. And then the conclusion you draw is the right moral conclusion. And you know why you're able to extract that part of the story? Because you're a Burkean at heart. This is an important thing. Our moral sensibilities are absolutely necessary if we are to maintain a belief in a free political economy. So the things that we talk about a lot on the podcast as a matter of policy, we presuppose their synthesis with our own moral intuition. And that comment of admiring persistence, admiring the ability to overcome that adversity, you know, there's something highly morally sensible in what you've said, my friend.
Well, that resonated with me because I think that's how a lot of the folks who listen to our show, unless they're just sadomasochists from the left, you can sometimes feel hopeless about California. But I think you are feeling this Friday morning, maybe because of the results of Tuesday's elections, partly because we're seeing progressives finally get called to account for their failures in a place like San Francisco. There's hope, brother. I feel really hopeful. And I think it's important for us to keep up our optimism to fight the good fight.
You know, Will, I totally agree. And I hope you don't mind that I push back just a tiny bit on one thing you said, sure. Though. I absolutely feel hope. And I absolutely am encouraged by the results of Tuesday's election. But my hope does not come from the results of the election. And I know you don't mean it that way. But if McAuliffe had won by 14 points, I'd still feel hopeful. First of all, Republicans are probably going to overplay this in the sense of like making we did not win a cultural war on Tuesday. We won a battle, and it looks as if there's better public sentiment on our side than we might have thought. All that's true. But when it comes to taking those things and applying them into politics, we are so incredibly capable of screwing it up. It's like not even, you know what I mean? Like we're probably going to go nominate Donald Trump or something. You know what I mean? Like there's plenty of ways to what is it? I always get this confused. The jaws of victory.
Oh, to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. That's the,
I think that we will probably continue to see an optimistic direction as the pendulum swings the other way against the insanity of the progressive left. I think that's a good thing. I have a lot of hope. And if we lose an election or two on the way, I'm not going to lose my hope in either of you. And I do believe it was one of the most profoundly important things President Reagan ever said, that the cause is never lost because the cause is never fully won. And I think at the end of the day, that vigilance is not something we have the luxury of forfeiting. So we keep fighting, but we fight as happy warriors. We fight as optimists. We fight with the playbook of a female immigrant lieutenant governor in the state of Virginia. The playbook of Glenn Youngkin, family man, Christian, came in, embraced some of the key principles of the present right wing mood in the country, but didn't get into the gutter, refused to sort of embrace craziness. You know, that's how we got to fight. Let's fight on the policies. Let's fight for the cause, and things will work out well. Truth always prevails.
Awesome, brother. All right. That's all we have time for today. You can always find this podcast on the National Review website, but it's easier for you and better for us if you subscribe, because that helps others find the show. Lizzy and LS, you'll find our email addresses, Twitter handles, and other fun details in the show notes. On behalf of my friend and co-host David Bonson, we give thanks as ever to show producer Sarah Schutte, recording engineers Brian Tong and Glenn Hall, and to all of our friends at National Review. Thanks also to Metalachi, the LA-based mariachi metal band, for our music. La Revolución continúa, la semana próxima.